Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, April 19th. This is Amuse News. I'm your host, RJ. I am really excited to be here today. We have a kind of a two-part episode today. So you're going to hear me go through a couple news items, as I always do now. And then at 12 o'clock today, I'm going to be talking to my friend Maggie Rose as a like separate little short interview. But today I'm going to be, as I said, giving you the news. And then I'm going to be talking to Capri Cafaro, who has a new show on PBS called America the Bountiful, which is really cool. And she also has a podcast on HRN. So we're going to be talking to Capri in a couple minutes. I just wanted to run through a few news items, as always. Let me tell you quickly. I'll tell you about this show that Capri is hosting, America the Bountiful. So just so you can stick around after the news and hear about it. So the show's described as shining a spotlight on the vibrant, untold food stories hidden in rural and small town America. So I've watched a couple episodes, and Capri is traveling around to the American heartland. She's from Ohio, like I am, and she is exploring the personal, emotionally moving chronicles of farmers, artisan, restaurateurs, and home cooks through the fare that they grow, produce, and eat. So it's going to be a really fun conversation. You should check out the show. It's on PBS, but you can also check it out streaming. So stay tuned for that in a second. So as you probably know, for each of these episodes, I want to bring you a couple pieces of news that are happening in the food world. There's a lot going on out there. And if you think I should be talking about something that I haven't talked about, please hit us up on social or send me a message. Most of you all know where to find me. It's a big day. We have a new Taylor Swift record. The NBA playoffs are starting. Fish is at the Sphere. If you know what that means, then you know what that means. But if you don't, that's fine too. Okay, first thing, I want to tell you about a newsletter I've been reading called The Food Section, which is really fun. Hannah Reskin, she has a bunch of great content on there. You can check that out at thefoodsection.com. But she sent out a newsletter today with food and drink picks from some of the bureau chiefs that she works with. So we get some really cool insight into some restaurants and bars and other purveyors in Nashville, Baton Rouge, West Virginia, and Charleston. And there's just a lot of really cool and interesting writing about food on the food section. So you should check that out. Really good podcast. If you all know the Good Food Podcast, you might know this already, but there's a new episode of the Good Food Podcast, which has a bunch of segments, which are all really interesting. There's a journalist, activist, and founder of the blog Gaza Mom, Laila El Haddad, who discusses how she's trying to keep the cuisine of Gaza alive as she tries to find solace during Ramadan. Really interesting conversation. There is a conversation with a chef who has two vegan barbecue and food and soul food trucks, which is really interesting. And then there's a conversation about pie. Anyway, great episode and really good podcast. I saw this article yesterday from the Food Institute about the all-night diner dying. Which was really sad news. If you're a live music person like I am, there sometimes you just need an all-night diner after a show, and it's getting harder to find. Apparently, it's fallen probably 20% since 2020, partially the pandemic, but also higher cost and fewer workers. So if you need that late-night diner, I was in Nashville seeing a show last year, and it was very hard to find a place to get food at midnight. So I guess I've experienced that, but you might have to look a little harder for those. It is Earth Day on Monday, and the Marine Stewardship Council, they are publicizing this month, Earth Month, and they're using a blue fish label, which was developed to help all of us easily find seafood that meets the world's leading standards for sustainable fishing. That means it comes from an MSC certified wild capture fishery. The hashtag Choose Blue you might see on social. And if you buy products with the MSC Bluefish label, you help support MSC certified fisheries. And I'm actually going to a dinner tonight in Philadelphia highlighting sustainable seafood put on by MSC. And I'll absolutely report back because from what I can see, it's going to be awesome. You can check them out at msc.org doing work to help support sustainable fisheries. And then lastly, I think Food and Wine just had to do this because tomorrow is 420. They revisited an article from 2015 and a study from Nature in 2015 talking about why cannabis makes you hungry. And there actually are chemical reasons, and they're kind of detailed in this story, which is in the show notes. You can check that out. But cannabis activates the receptor CB1, which is found throughout the body, and alerts it to release hunger-promoting hormones. So through this this study that was in Nature in 2015, they explained that even if you had dinner and you smoked pot, all of a sudden, all these neurons that told you to stop eating become the drivers of hunger. And of course, this is all like fun and funny for still after all these years, the cannabis puns keep coming. But of course, there are real world help for people, people getting their appetite back from chemotherapy and all kinds of things that medical uses. So it was a good article, but, you know, just in time for 420 tomorrow. So that's my quick rundown of the news. I think I'm going to bring Capri on now to talk about the show. Hey, Capri.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. It's going great. How is it today in Ohio?
Overcast. You know, we had a couple of tornadoes, as a matter of fact, earlier in the week. It's a little early for tornado season, but that has obviously changed. I feel like I blame climate change for that. But so it's, you know, it's been a little crazy. We barely missed a big tornado. Well, not big, but a tornado coming through right near us on Wednesday. But you know, dodged a bullet, all is good. And, you know, I have to say, I know I'm here to talk about America the Bountiful, but knowing that you're a music person, I now just want to talk about music because that is my other love in life is music. And I like have concert, will travel. I will travel like the earth for things when it comes to, you know, bands and live music. So you ever want me back to talk about tunes, you know,
what's the last best concert?
I saw two things. I saw back to back. I saw the Chemical Brothers, who I had not seen since 2001 in a warehouse in Washington, D.C. And then I saw the last kind of hurrah for the Teenage Cancer Trust series that Roger Daltrey from The Who has been putting on for the last 24 years. Both of these were at Royal Albert Hall, back to back. One was Saturday, one was Sunday. And the one at the Teenage Cancer Trust one was just like legendary. It was literally Robert Plant, Paul Weller from The Jam, Roger Daltrey, and a bunch of other like British people that you might not necessarily know, Kelly Jones from the Stereophonics. It was very, very, very cool. And for That's a great cause cool. too.
That's awesome. When was that? Was that recently or was that?
That was about a month ago.
Awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
What's, I really hate when people ask me this question, but I'll ask you anyway. Do you have like a favorite concert memory?
Oh gosh. Yeah, I mean, Faith No More, Rock on Seine, 2009.
Wow.
Faith No More, only to be potentially eclipsed by Hyde Park, 2014, Motorhead's Soundgarden, Faith No More, and Black Sabbath.
Wow. That is awesome.
I mean, so as you can tell, I have a type of music, at the same time, you know, the Chemical Brothers don't fit in. Like I have a weird soft spot for like, you know, George Michael and Simply Red. I love Dr. Dre and Snoop. I'm a West Coast rap girl from the 90s. So I do have eclectic and I love my soft sational. Bring me some Sills and Croft any day of the week. So
that's so awesome to hear. We did not talk about this beforehand. So, but I love it. Also, it sounds like you sound like a Fish fan. You're like my favorite show was this Fish show from 1997 or a Fish show from 1999 or the Fish show I just saw. You know, it's kind of like you get
it. It's true. My one final closing thing on this is I, funnily enough, do not like jam bands, but I love prog rock. So I love Yes. Mm-hmm. And I will sit there and listen to like, you know, Chris Squire's 22-minute like, you know, bass solo. And somehow that's okay to me. Or like Jethro Tull. But like I can't get into Fish or the Dead or like DMB, Dave Matthews. I like them, but I'm not like in it. In the same way that like, you know, folks that are in it are in it.
Which is interesting because as you alluded to, like the prog rock and jam genres have a lot of overlap.
Yep.
Right. Especially in terms of, yeah, long solos and in the way and song structure and all that. Okay.
Absolutely.
We could talk about this for a little longer.
We really could.
So Capri, you've been hosting a show, an audio show on HRN for a while called Eat Your Heartland Out. And now, so this America the Bountiful, which I kind of described a little bit earlier, it's a new TV series and I got to check out a couple episodes. It's really cool. And I'm just curious where this came from and how long this has been in the works.
Well, I think it's been sort of in my head for probably a decade. It really was inspired, frankly, by being in Northeastern Ohio, and, you know, recognizing kind of the role that food and culture play in my backyard. So you may be, you know, aware of this as growing up in Ohio, and a lot of folks throughout the quote heartland probably also realize that summer times in particular are really driven by fairs and festivals, right? So not just your county fairs and your state fairs and that sort of thing, but, you know, your, in my case, the Geneva Grape Jamboree and the Huntsburg Pumpkin Festival and then like a million Italian fests and Greek fests and Croatian fests and pierogi dash and all these sort of things. We also have on the north coast of Lake Erie, a burgeoning wine country, draws in a lot of tourism. We have the fourth largest Amish settlement in the world here, Middlefield in Northeast Ohio, which has its own culinary culture and draw. And so I thought to myself, if this is what we have in my little corner of Northeastern Ohio, all these kind of things that not only bring community together, but, you know, I think educate and inform others about different cultures. What else is out there in the world in the United States that does the same thing? How, you know, so I kind of sought out to try to tell America's story through food, our immigration story, our migration story, and doing it in a way where we're kind of choosing one food, one crop, however you want to describe it, as that guide through an individual state. Eat Your Heartland Out was kind of part of this. And when I had this initial concept, I kind of thought that, you know, there'd be more of this like tourism type of programming that would be the TV side. And Eat Your Heartland Out would be more of like the deeper nerd like dive. It didn't totally end up that way, but what it has, they're very, very complementary as far as content is concerned. Eat Your Heartland Out focuses specifically on the intersection of food and culture in the American Midwest. Sometimes we deviate from the actual geographic boundaries of that because you can make some real arguments on what is culturally Midwestern in places like Erie, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, New York, and even in the mountain states. We do a lot of different things on Eat Your Heartland Out, whereas we take individual states and we use a food to be our tour guide. So it really is history and travel using with food as the guide in all of it.
So I guess I'm just going to go back quickly because people might not know you've had like an amazing, like almost unbelievable series of careers leading you to where you are. You've done everything. How are you bridging, particularly like you were a Ohio State Senator,
yep.
And you were a political commentator on TV and you've done cooking shows. And I mean, it's amazing how you've kind of bridged that. Is this like a bridge between all of that in a way? Because I think the way you talk about culture and food, political stuff is not, you know, issue related, of course, but I don't know. I'm just curious how that experience has maybe traveling around and talking to people probably like throughout that time. But I'm just curious how that experience crosses over because they're very different, but I guess maybe more similar than we might think.
You're absolutely right. And I will say that political commentary has nothing to do with what I do now and with good reason. The only transferable skill there is being in front of a camera, in that sense. But, there is a lot now. While obviously none of the content I do has any kind of political anything. So I want to be clear about that, particularly since this is a nonprofit media organization and public television as well. There's nothing political about what I do. And again, with good reason. However, it is about people. And ultimately, that's what public service is about. At least that was what it was about for me. And so you are right. I mean, what I just described to you was really informed by my time in public service specifically, because if you're doing your job, you're going to every single community event. And you know, I was going to every single community event in my, you know, radius and, you know, really saw how it would bring people together. I also served on the Senate Agriculture Committee for, I think, six or seven of my 10 years in office. So, and I represented a pretty large agricultural community. I have urban, rural, and suburban communities that I represented. But, you know, if you are going to be a good public servant, you spend a lot of time talking to people, as you alluded to, and, you know, people whose voices are often not heard, and they want to be listened to and they deserve to be amplified. And I think I bring that core sensibility and objective to all of my work, ensuring that, you know, the content that I have is inclusive, that is, you know, shining a light on things that people wouldn't necessarily, you know, think that are kind of like, you know, mythbusters of certain things, whether it's, you know, female farmers or female, you know, fisher women, crab women on, you know, going out there and harvesting crabs in the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, you name it from you know, the entire kind of perspective or spectrum rather. And that does come, I think, from my heart in public service and a desire to, like I said, kind of amplify voices that may or may not be marginalized, but certainly are not getting the, you know, the attention or respect that they deserve. And that I think is part of the objective of both Eat Your Heart Laid Out and America the Bountiful.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. And I think when you watch the show, you can feel that. I mean, I think the one that I saw was the most recently was the pears in Oregon. And I think it was just such a, I guess on one hand, like that is kind of the PBS approach, right? It's like, it's personal, it's like in depth, it's thoughtful, but you have these like very, very intimate conversations with people who are talking about something that's like so near and dear to their hearts. I think it's really interesting and different than any kind of, it's not celebrating, you know, like a celebrity chef or looking at like the most popular restaurant. It's really like going into the weeds of like, you know, something that, but you can tell the people you're talking to are so passionate and so, you know, thoughtful about what they do. I think it's a really interesting look at food that I think is sort of different. So I don't know, curious, like, is that, what were you trying to achieve when you go to like film and was it different from other stuff you've done in terms of pre-production and how you prep for these things?
Well, I, you know, first I'll say this is why it's public television and not, you know, a sort of run-of-the-mill network that you would think of, you know, because it isn't, you know, just a straight-up travel show where you're running around, and you're like, check this out, like it's kitschy or it's this or it's yummy. And we do have that in the mix, but it really is about getting those stories. And so again, my approach to this, to the research I do for America the Bountiful and Eat Your Heart Laid Out are somewhat similar, you know, trying to come up with themes. And I'm always kind of trying to dig deep and find unique stories that I think might break. Both are, I think, reflective of that regional culture, but also may break the mold of what people might think is, you know, the obvious situation that might happen. Again, using Maryland as the example. Okay, we all know about Maryland crabs, but would you expect a all-female crabbing crew? You know, and so in that sense, you know, we are looking, and it's a multi-tiered process. So I do research on, you know, well, first we figure out, you know, what do we want to choose as that particular, you know, food for the guide. And, you know, some of it is obvious, like maple in Vermont. And some of it, I refuse to be, if there is an alternative, I'm like, I am not doing peaches in Georgia. I'm doing pecans in Georgia because that is something that is different. In some of the larger states, as we are getting into season two and looking at places like California and Florida, where you have a number of different things, you have to really sort of, and they're such big states, you know, how do we want to approach it? And so I kind of, we've had like a short list of, you know, like in California, we're looking at, you know, avocados, olives, garlic and pistachios. And so you have to take a bunch of things into consideration. What's in season? Like, how can we plug it into everything else? Because this filming season is very summer top heavy. So in order to not be like literally permanently on the road, how can we like, you know, if places like California and Florida, they might have longer growing seasons for certain things. So we have some practical aspects, but then we're looking for what's a better story as well, you know, if there's a lot of different, you know, different crops, what is really going to be a more insightful, thoughtful thing maybe that people haven't talked about before? And then getting into identifying, you know, I'm always looking for like multi-generational family farmers, you know, restaurants or, you know, food purveyors that are doing something unique with the product in some way, showing that there's a new application to something that has been grown for, you know, centuries or, you know, whatever. And then we're always trying to bring in a little bit of fun. So we try to, you know, incorporate maybe a festival if we can, or, you know, a fun, you know, diner, somebody that's doing something totally crazy, with the food. Like, you know, there was this maple concoction that literally was like a maple soft serve with maple, the candy, cotton candy coming out of it and stuff like that. So, you know, we try to like have this kind of balance of, you know, a trajectory of kind of, this is where it comes from. You know, this is its historical cultural significance. These are the people that are making it, growing it. These are some of the ways that it's being used now, you know, in different kinds of applications. Like you saw, for example, Perry, right? The liqueur and the pear episode, which is kind of different. And then here's how somebody is doing it. Like, again, using the pear episode, multi-generational family farm. They decided they wanted to do, you know, agritourism, and they have this, you know, lovely, you know, pear pizzas. And so, you know, we kind of try to put all of these different types of elements together in the show.
That's great. Expanding the farm, it reminded me of some of the wineries in like in Northern California where you go and it's like, you know, you don't just get the wine, you get like an experience, which I think is really cool. And it's nice to see these different profiles of people who are, again, taking what they do so seriously, you know. What was it like, just mostly out of curiosity, creating a show for TV versus podcast? I mean, I know you've done TV before, but like, you know, scripting and pre-production.
It's totally different. And I have to say, I have to give credit where credit is due. I work with an incredible production company out of Minneapolis and Wisconsin, Credo Nonfiction, Jesse Raisler, who I featured on one of the more recent episodes of Eat Your Heartland Out. And we, you know, as I started to, I had this concept and I actually was writing some articles for the Food Network website and talk to their digital folks about, I have this idea, this and that. And they gave me a list of people to potentially talk to. And Credo Nonfiction actually was one that they had worked with on the digital side. And we just totally connected off the bat. And so he and I worked together. They do most of the scripting side, certainly. But, you know, we'll both research. We compare notes. You know, but when it comes to the actual script, you know, and logistics side, you know, they very much are part of that. I will say that, I mean, even though I've done a lot of television, live TV, it's a very different skill set, very, very different, you know, because you have to be ready for anything, but you do have some opportunity to, you know, shift things around and whatever, but you also are looking, you know, you're spending hours, days to put together something that's 27 minutes long. And through that process though, and over the last year, I remember distinctly, actually, I feel like it was like maybe 13 episodes a season. I think like episode 5 maybe is when I felt like I was making a turning, like it was a turning point for me where I was starting to get much more comfortable and understanding the other side, sort of the technical side of like, okay, I know that we need these cutaway shots and, you know, this should, like, we might want to think about doing this one and slower motion, which is like 60 versus 24. Like I've learned all that stuff. And obviously we have a director on set, but you know, I will throw my like 2 cents in, and my 2 cents are actually starting to become valuable. And when we had some folks that had COVID and we were kind of in a skeleton crew situation, I had to sort of rise to the occasion. And that actually was kind of when that turning point kind of happened, because I was like, okay, what have I seen? And, you know, and look, this is public television. We don't have an unlimited budget. And I do want to thank American Farmland Trust, as our lead underwriter, for America the Bountiful. They've been incredible partners, and really share a lot of, I think, the same mission that we do.
That's really cool. Yeah, I think, you know, I've done a podcast for, I think, 11 years now, and we do live events sometimes, and we'll, but every time I'm in a live event situation where there's video involved, I'm like, shit, there's so much to think about. And I can't even imagine, like, for some narrative stuff, you know, you're like, it's just such a more in-depth thing. It's not like you're sitting down to do an interview live. You're, you know, you're creating a whole world that you have to, again, extract that small amount of content from.
Right. And we know, I mean, we know going in, you know, so as part of, you know, the process, again, you know, sort of, you know, I certainly have my own questions, but we know from a story arc perspective, the folks at Credo, like, make sure that, you know, they have like some sort of guideposts, if you will. So mm-hmm. to make sure that we kind of get the story arc that our objective is trying to meet. And so we come into that knowing, kind of the things that, you know, we want, but I will say that the way that we approach this, and particularly Jesse as a director, and co-executive producer with me, like, we don't try to over direct the people. Like, we want them to talk. And I think that that is also where my public service skills come into this, mm-hmm. because because we do interview real people, right? And so real people aren't used to being in front of the camera. You need to make them feel comfortable. You want them to be at ease. You don't want them to be, you know, unnecessarily distracted. And so, you know, we don't want to be like over the top. I'm like, we want you to say this, like, that is not what we do. So we kind of let it go and flow, but, you know, every now and again, we'll go back in and be like, you know, for whatever reason, there's an airplane overhead or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, can you say that line again? Because it just is, you know, is what it is. Cause you are out in the wild.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's crazy. And the intimacy that I was referring to earlier, I think is interesting and surprising to some degree, because you do have to get these people so comfortable. And I felt like everyone you talked to was so comfortable being on camera, which was great to see, because it just creates a much more authentic kind of picture of what they're talking about.
I appreciate that. I'm glad that that's coming through. That is wonderful feedback.
Where is the best place for people to check out the show?
Well, you obviously can check your local listings for, you know, your local public television, PBS affiliates, PBS app, PBS.org, America, the Bountiful Show.com is our website. And we continue to try to update every week, more and more stations across the country. You know, we're getting closer and closer into that, you know, 95, you know, percent number. We're getting closer. We're up there. So I think we're like at 70 now. I don't know, but it doesn't really matter. Bottom line is that even if your local market doesn't have it, you can see it on the PBS app streaming, and PBS.org. You can also, because there's a partnership between PBS and Hulu Live, you can see it on Hulu in the markets that have it on TV. Nice. Which is also cool. You can also follow us at America the Bountiful on Instagram. So we'll keep you updated, particularly on social. I'm going out in the field in literally like 5 days to start filming again. We're going to tell the story of Pennsylvania through mushrooms. And I'll be out there in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania next week. So
that's so great. Yeah, you'll be very, very, very nearby.
That's right.
I am. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, really cool. I can't wait to watch more. And thanks for coming on to share this with us. And, you know, we look forward to seeing more.
Thanks so much. And I'm so proud to be part of the HRN family. So thanks again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Capri. And everyone watching, thank you so much for tuning in. If you're listening to the podcast, hang on for 1 second, because I'm going to include an interview with Maggie Rose, amazing musician. If you're watching live, we'll be back at 12 o'clock for that conversation. So come back in about an hour. But if you're listening, just hang on for a second. Thanks, everybody. All right. Hello again. I am here live with my friend and amazing musician, Maggie Rose. Hey, Maggie.
Hey, RJ. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you too. So you are, first of all, congrats on the new album and all that. I want to ask you about all of that. But right now you're on a bus and you're starting your tour tonight.
Yes. Tonight is night one. We're at Delmar Hall in St. Louis.
So how you come from Nashville and how do rehearsals work? How do you get ready? Because you have a bunch of new material, you have all kinds of stuff to prep for. Plus you're doing a lot of appearances and interviews and all kinds of things. People can see you on national TV and all that. how are you approaching the rehearsals for this tour?
Yeah, it's crazy time right now, but it's fun. Luckily I have this amazing studio where I actually got to record the album. It's called Starstruck in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm managed by Starstruck as well. So I have access to this beautiful big tracking room called the gallery where we get to set up all week. And we've been there since Sunday.
Nice.
You know, we shed a lot of the new music, but we've been playing most of the new album. But of course we wanted to change up the set and make sure we're playing a few of the old familiar tunes that people hopefully will expect in the set. And the sequencing of the set is super important, as you know, and we want to give people, you know, a new way to present this album. So we worked through a lot of the musical components for the first 2 days, and then we set up the rehearsal space to mimic what our stage plot looks like. So we could go through every little motion of, you know, getting the guitar and plugging it in and, you know, where is our, like, spatially how it's going to feel on stage. We also have these really cool string parts that our friend, our mutual friend Don Hart,
amazing,
put together. And while it would be lovely to travel with a 64-piece orchestra that he helped us implement, we are going to be doing some, you know, tracks that we're going to fly to feature those parts that Don wrote. So just a few little components that are new that we're incorporating that require a lot of rehearsal and, you know, getting the formula down.
How do you do those strings live? How's that going to work?
So we are just such a live band, all the vocals, and we're a 5-piece band, so we cover as much as we can. But my drummer physically, like, fires those tracks for the songs that have some string components on it.
Wow.
And for a few of the songs, we recorded these live sessions at the Caverns in Pelham, Tennessee, back in December. So the arrangements of those are slightly different and kind of work a little bit better to how we played the songs live. And Don, of course, helped us arrange those as well.
Don is the best. I mean, wow, that's really, really cool.
And I know. Thank you for introducing us.
I was reading an interview yesterday or today, and you mentioned that, and I kind of knew that that's like how it all came together. But now, because you and Don have now worked together a bunch, so I kind of just forgot that that's how it all came together. But it's so awesome that, you know, this like weird fish community can expand in ways that none of us could anticipate.
Oh, totally. I mean, I was talking to my, you're probably referring to the Live for Live Music article.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just sort of rehashing how I met all these amazing people, yourself included, during the pandemic. You know, as hard of a time as that was, I do feel like my community got so big. I was on your podcast, Past, Present, Future Live, and then I think Don tweeted at me after having heard the podcast and heard my song on Lightning 100, and just all the things that came together with you and Don and Tom Marshall, and then my podcast with Osiris. And, you know, it was kind of a pretty prolific time for me in terms of gaining some really talented creative friends. Even we were apart.
That's so awesome. I love that reflection is so awesome, because I think I started that podcast and I was like in my laundry room because I just moved into a house. I think it was April or May of 2020 when we did that interview. So
right.
Nobody knew it was going to happen. And then, you know, it's so great to see. And now we have a lot of mutual friends, and you, I mean, your career has just continued to grow in ways that are not surprising at all, but really fun to watch. I mean, the new album, first of all, tell us a little bit about the album and how it came together and how long you've been working on it.
So I probably wrote some of those songs over 2 years ago. The album itself was mastered last January.
Okay.
And, you know, it was just something that I wanted to make because it's what we do. It wasn't really like some outcome oriented exercise for me, but I kind of subscribe to the Field of Dreams mantra. It's like build it and they will come. And
yeah,
you know, I have all these amazing friends that I've accumulated over the years living in Nashville this long. And you know, I had Sadler Vaden and Chad Gamble from Jason Isbell's 400 unit, Zach Cockrell from The Shakes, Caitlin Connor and Kyle Lewis from my touring band, and Peter Levin, who plays with the Allman Brothers, and Amanda Shires, and of course Ben Tanner, who produced my last record as well, Have a Seat. I wanted to work with him again, especially with such, you know, kind of personal, intimate songs. It felt like a safe space to bring these back to him and have a second effort. And you know, Bobby Holland, who's an incredible producer and engineer, he produced another album of mine. So it's just like all these amazing friends and songs that I wrote to kind of get through a tough time with the pandemic, and also just take stock of where I was. And I got to realize it with just like this dream team of people who really put their heart and energy into this music. And then it was done and I didn't know how I was going to release it. And Big Loud, the label I'm signed to now, came along after the fact, which is just like, I mean, it, you know, this industry, that kind of marriage and just chemistry doesn't really happen. And seldom do labels just fully embrace what an artist is doing and just accept it as it is. And you know, they didn't try and manufacture it or rearrange it or have me tinker with it. They just put it out, and it's been a really beautiful time. I've never released an album and felt so calm in the process. Like,
that's awesome.
Schedule's busy, but just the energy surrounding it feels like breathing. It's good, and I'm very excited now that the tour is about to kick off. It's really going to feel real.
That's great. And I wanted to just mention that you got to be on the Today Show performing, which is just like such a different thing probably than you were, you know, have done in the past. I assume I've never been on the Today Show, but you're hitting these people who are, you know, it's very much in the mainstream, which is really cool. But is that a like surreal experience to be kind of going in at these new levels, or does it feel like you're just kind of part of the path?
It's totally surreal. I've been on the Today Show once before, and I remember it just flying by so quickly. So I made sure this time to try and just really enjoy the moment. And you get up at 4 a.m. and you sound check at 5 a.m. And
wow.
Then the hardest part is waiting the time in between the sound check. And then when you actually go live, I think I like went back to my hotel room and watched The Terminal, like some old Tom Hanks movie. And I was just like fidgeting the whole time, trying to not think about the imminent moment that was ahead of me.
They just make you sit and wait.
Yeah. It's so cool to have a song that, you know, I've been familiar with for a long time, but then perform it and give it away to this large audience. And they sort of, like, the song gleans new meaning because people's stories then start to become attached to the song. And as they digest what it means to them, it's very renewing.
That's amazing. I'm really glad to hear that. And you're starting tonight in St. Louis, and then you have shows, like, you know, with some breaks, of course, but pretty much through the rest of the year. And I'm sure more will be added too, which is really cool. And you will, for those of you in this area where I am in Philadelphia, May 29th is a big date on our calendar for your show at World Cafe Live. So we're psyched about that.
We're so psyched. It's going to be a party.
Yeah, it's going to be a party.
A lot of people have already committed to coming. So I hope that you guys grab the last tickets and come hang out with us, because by then we'll be a well-oiled machine for sure.
That's awesome. What do you do with the songs on the road that's different from like how they come out in the studio? Like, do they change at all? Like, how do you, cause like you said, you kind of released the album and now the support and the publicity machine and the momentum and the social media traffic, it's all like, everyone's just so excited. How do these songs evolve once you hit the road?
Well, I have such a stellar band. As you know, you've gotten to meet the crew that I get to travel with, and yeah, they're so capable of improvising. And you know, I think what makes us kind of work in the jam scene is just their ability to play and just how musical they are. So we want to honor the album that people are listening to and, you know, hit certain musical hooks that people come to anticipate, but it's also a live moment that we want to give a unique experience to people who are there, you know, with us at that moment, that we kind of take some liberties on solos and like they're singing harmonies that are maybe a few extra vocal parts than might be on the record. And we have just contextually, we add a lot to these songs that, you know, transitions might not be on the album that you have at home.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And I appreciate that you kind of have that perspective, like in the jam band world, that like, it's a living thing, right? It's not
right.
Like
you have an audience, there's a rapport.
Yeah.
It's not like you and I are talking. It's a conversation. There's no script. So you want to make sure that you're reacting and in that moment with the audience. And sometimes that will mean a different interpretation of the music for that evening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really cool. And I'm excited to see you all on the road and to hear how these shows go. And congrats on the album. I mean, this is like I said, the things that I've seen from, you know, people who are longtime fans and new listeners and people seeing you in these various outlets. It's really, really cool. I hope you're feeling the love from all the different directions.
Thank you. It's a really happy time. I'm ready to work on the next one though.
Well, I hope you can, you know, get some time playing this one and maybe, you know, I don't know, get some downtime eventually, I guess. Does that happen? Does downtime happen?
Sure. Yeah.
as much as it does.
You alluded to this earlier. We've really just only announced the first leg of this tour that will take us through the end of August. And your suspicion that we'll announce more dates is definitely granted. So
okay.
It's warranted, rather. So we'll be playing all over the country until the end of this year and into the next. And while I am ready to work on the next record, these things take time. And I'm going to enjoy this one for the moment.
That's really great. And I just want to say before I let you go, we are for HRN, we're doing our 15th anniversary, and your team was nice enough to donate a couple of VIP passes to your show at Brooklyn Bowl in a couple weeks, which I think, you know, as a hometown show for you, you know, actually, let me just say first, this is through an organization called Charity Buzz. So if you look at the show notes or check out charitybuzz.com and search Maggie or HRN, you'll see this. But Maggie, what's a hometown show kind of like for you, you know, when you're rolling out this record?
Well, okay, every show is special, but
yes,
I will say Brooklyn Bowl, I have two amazing artists opening for me. Crystal Rose, who's my friend, not related to me, but incredible artist, and Fancy Haygood. They're both doing some sets to open up the night. And because it's a hometown show, it's going to probably be a little more bedazzled for the cast of people that we'll have on stage. And because I have Don Hart at my disposal in Nashville, we're going, yes, to have some live strings. And I love Brooklyn Bowl. I feel like the production that they have at that venue just is over the top, and it's going to be a pretty awesome night.
That is great. Thank you for previewing that. And for those of you who want to, check out the link in the show notes, and you can bid on this. And it's two VIP tickets to the show and dinner for two at Blue Aster and two nights at the Russell Hotel. I think it's a pretty awesome package.
I want it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you can, you know, I'll send you the link.
I might have to place a bid myself.
Yeah. But thanks for doing that. And thanks for taking a few minutes. I'm really glad I got to catch you like at the beginning of this tour. I'm really excited to see where it goes, and congrats again for the album and everything.
Well, thank you for being such a big part of this story and connecting me with a lot of the people that made this album come to fruition. So
thank you for saying
you're part of the family. Yeah,
I appreciate that. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you here in Philly in May, and everyone else, you can check out the album, obviously, wherever you listen to music, but check out maggierosemusic.com/shows if you want to see Maggie in person soon, which you definitely should. So thanks, Maggie. Good luck. Good luck on the tour.
Thank you so much, RJ. It's good to talk to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.